Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
108. Wow, look at that. Michigan Avenue bathed in sunlight, blue skies, and sunshine. I hope you are too. This is John. Happy day after Mother's Day. We hope you had a good weekend and a good Mommy's Day. I sure did. I'll tell you about it now. Here we go. There's nothing quite like the feeling of getting things accomplished. And I've been telling you lately that Brenda and I are moving from Minneapolis to Chicago. You know now I'm on 1 to 3 in the afternoons here. And so we've moved from Minneapolis to Chicago. But it's a process. Actually, we haven't fully moved. I've moved, but Brenda's still up there with the dogs and the house full of stuff. You know how you know that moving is the worst thing in the world? Moving is the worst thing in the world because everything you own now has to be a decision point. Keep it, sell it, throw it away, box it up, move it, and you own a lot of stuff.
Are you a saver or a thrower?
We're a keeper. We're kind of keepers.
I'll come over and help. I ditch everything. I'm not a saver.
We're kind of in the process of doing that now.
But you have, you're downsizing too, aren't you?
Well, that's the terrifying
that's the issue,
thing.
Right?
See, because if you go from 2,000 square feet to 2,000 square feet, you can just put all your crap in boxes. We've had guys just empty drawers and say, here, we'll move it. This will be we are transferring the problem. We're not solving the problem. So that stuff just gets moved. In fact, I have in our crawl space boxes that we have not opened up from the previous move.
So no reason to bring them again.
But now, true enough, I mean, whatever's in there, we didn't need it for the last 4 years, so let's not even open the box. But it was a box of stuff so important to me that I decided to move it from the previous place. So I kind of want to look. The problem is I ain't got room for it because now we're going from about 2,500 square feet to about 1,500 square feet, and some of it isn't going to come.
It feels good to purge, though, doesn't it?
I think it will. But
it does. It really does. Except, you know, there's some things like, you know, your kids' artwork or some really special stuff like that you'll never get rid of. But the other stuff is just stuff. It's okay.
So I went home over the weekend and, you know, gave Brenda her cologne. And then we decided to attack the attic in the garage. That's a special place. The stuff in your basement, you know you're kind of going to need, want, love. The attic in the garage is just about 20 minutes before garbage. It's just stuff that you're putting there that you don't have a place for, and you're not even sure you ever want to see it again. You know, it's inaccessible, but yet you're still clinging to it. With the exception of a Christmas tree and off-season lawn implements, the stuff up there you never need to see again, and we had a lot of it. I was in the backyard, and at one point, I found myself doing the following, and that is walking around with a pencil in my hand from a golf course, those tiny little pencils they give you.
Right.
And I was trying to decide what to do with this pencil and made a separate trip to a giant garbage container and dropped it in there and felt like I had accomplished something. And as I took the time to do that, it dawned on me that we'll never get anywhere if I do it like this.
Correct.
Lou Manfredini's on line six. Mr. Fix-It, you know him as. Hi, Lou. How are you?
Hi, John. Cleaning and organizing is the worst.
Where are you? You sound like you're in a large barrel yourself.
Is that better?
No. Where are you?
Did you put Lou in a garbage can?
I'm in my office.
Are you on a speakerphone?
Not anymore.
Say hello.
Hello.
That's pretty good. Do you have any furniture in there? It sounds like you're in an empty room.
No, it's actually, I do all my recordings in here. It's my studio, too. It must just be a bad line.
Or are you in the now attic of my garage that we cleaned out over the weekend and is now just empty and hollow and has that wonderful hollow sound?
You forgot to take me with you.
Yeah, yeah. So we did get a lot of that done, but I'm just telling you, I come to you today from your future. And this is what you should do, what Kim said. That is, start the purging process now. Because otherwise, someday, you know you're not going to live in that house forever. You'll die if nothing else. Everything is going to have to come out of that house. It should be an ongoing process. Don't wait until you have to move, because you'll be sorry if you do. All right, that's my speech for America today. Lou, but that's not why I called you, Lou.
Oh, all right.
Hey, Kim, is Bertrand over there?
I don't know where he was. He was here and then he left.
He's supposed to play handyman poker with us, and I can't even find him.
I don't know where he is. Yeah. Is he supposed to come down there? I can play. No. I can sub. I know a little bit about tools.
Well, the way you play handyman poker is we all brag about what we did over the weekend, and whoever has the best handyman story wins the prize.
Okay.
Do you want to play?
Sure.
Here we go.
Handyman, handyman, does what Lou Manfredini can. Fixes tubes in a flash. Guess who just saved some cash? Hey there, here goes the handyman.
One more verse, hold on.
Is he strong? Listen, bub. He's got liquid plumber blood. Here he comes, a hammering. He can duct tape anything. Hey there, here comes the handyman.
Okay, so I don't have anything really fancy to brag about, but my handyman poker entry today will be from the weekend. I cleaned the attic in my garage. Every single item in there came out, and it now has a home. It has a place. All right, Kim, what have you got?
Used an Allen wrench to tighten a doorknob.
Wow.
That's big. Come on, Lou.
Used an Allen wrench to tighten the doorknob. Oh, the little screw that holds the bracket on?
The doorknob kept pulling off.
It's
the
amazing how effective off. That will be if you just do that. All right, Lou, you get to be the judge.
Well, I got to tell you, I actually had a doctor's appointment today, and I was leaving the doctor. He said, you know, I just bought a set of Allen wrenches today. And his comment was, and for a guy like me using Allen wrenches, that's a monumental task.
That's how I feel.
Tim wins.
Wow.
It's hard to find an Allen wrench that fits. You know, there's lots of sizes.
All right. Well, congratulations.
Beginner's lock.
Metric and standard.
You know, the thing about an Allen wrench, too, is you're never going to use it again. You know, you get that Allen wrench, you go, oh, that's great, and then you put it in your toolbox. You will never need that Allen wrench.
Well, again. We only need that one just to tighten that doorknob, because that door handle comes off all the time.
Well, that's right, so keep that handy anyway.
Though.
All right, well, what do you know? I'm 0 for 1. Thank you, Kim. Well played.
Anytime. Just tell Bertrand to
disappear. You'll have plenty to do when you get your new place.
By the way, speaking of real estate, Lou, did you read the story? Have you been following the J.B. Pritzker story today?
I have not, no.
You know, he's the billionaire that's going to run for governor on the Democratic side.
Got big ideas.
Yeah, and yeah, it's kind of funny. He's got ads. He's a big dude. He looks a little like Chris Christie. He sort of plays with that, and I don't know much about this guy except he's a billionaire. J.B. Pritzker, the billionaire would-be governor, bought the historic mansion next door to his even bigger home on Chicago's Gold Coast, let it fall into disrepair, and then argued that it was now uninhabitable, so that he could have a $230,000 reduction in his property taxes. Pritzker, his wife, and their two children live in a palatial three-story home in the Gold Coast with more than 12,500 square feet of living space and a two-story coach house. They bought that for $14.5 million in May of 06. Boy, that was a bad time to be putting $14 million into a property, wasn't it? 06?
Yeah.
And then he spent an additional amount fixing it up, between $11 and $25 million more he put into his Gold Coast place.
Wow.
And then, when the smaller mansion, designed in 1894, went on sale, they bought that too. They paid $3.7 million. So they got these two really rich, really expensive houses. Pritzker refurbished the outside of the Federal-style home, but the inside had fallen into disrepair, or has, while he's owned it. The toilets have been disconnected, and the home has no functioning bathrooms or kitchens. A kitchen, according to documents, Pritzker's lawyer filed with Cook County Assessor Joseph Berrios, arguing that the smaller mansion is therefore vacant and uninhabitable. Those lawyers convinced Berrios to slash its assessed value from $6.2 million to $1.1 million. That's the way to get your property taxes reduced. Pull out the toilets.
And the kitchen.
Still, I'll bet there's some people on Lower Wacker Drive going, oh, no, that's not uninhabitable. Trust me, that's habitable. Mm-hmm. That's allowed Pritzker to get $230,000 in property tax breaks and refunds. He's gone from $117,000 to $19,000, an 83% reduction. That was instead of the $117,000 he otherwise would have had to pay in property taxes, which would fund the Chicago Public Schools, the city, and other local governments, says the Sun-Times. Don't you love how they get that little dig in there? Everybody wants to reduce their property taxes. Here's my point, Lou. I'm not sure that anybody should have to pay $115,000 or $230,000 in property taxes, because you're not using that much in services. I know that you're rich and your house is rich, and these numbers are all preposterous. But when I get to be king, I think I'm going to cap the point after which you will no longer have to pay an increase in property taxes. You're not going to use any more fire services or schools or city services of any kind. You're not going to drink more water. So just because your house is really expensive and you have a lot of money, don't you think at some point it gets to be a little ridiculous, the amount of property taxes some of these houses are assessed for?
Well, I'll give an example. When I was building houses in, you know, in Lincoln Park and Lakeview, we would buy, now this is 20 years ago, we would buy houses for $300,000 and $400,000, and we would tear them to the ground. So now it's a vacant lot. And one of the very first things we would do would go back to the county and say, all right, this is a vacant lot.
Right.
And the taxes would be reduced because it was not connected to city services or anything. And so say that, you know, $300,000 or $400,000 house had a tax bill of back then probably $3,000.
Okay.
It would get reduced to $700. But then when we would go and build a $1 million house and sell it, which we would, you know, people would be, these new owners would be like, oh my God, this is awesome. Look at, I have a $1 million house and my taxes are only $700. I go, wait a minute. You're going to be reassessed when they come and take a look at this house. And you should plan on 2% of the selling price as being your taxes.
Yeah, I've seen those numbers, 1.5%, 2%, depending on where, what city and state and all.
Right. And the problem is that we fund everything in Illinois through property taxes. And so this is the way they get everybody. And, you know, it's funny when you say the thing about the Pritzker, and it sounds crazy, right, to me. I'm like, that is nuts. But it's the same thing if you remember the whole story when Donald Trump was running for president and where he didn't pay taxes, you know, and for whatever reason it was, he had the loss and he said he didn't pay taxes.
Oh, yeah, right.
There was an outrage. There was an outrage that he didn't pay taxes. And, you know, his point was, whoever wants to pay taxes within the legal limits of the law. And obviously this whole kitchen and bathroom thing is a little glitch in the law that evidently, according to the story, Mr. Pritzker took advantage of.
It says here, the assessor's ruling also meant that Pritzker was due partial refunds on the taxes that he paid between 2012 and 14. He got three refund checks last year, totaling $132,000, writes the Sun-Times, money that reduced the amount of property taxes that schools and other local governments expected to receive. Okay, we get it. We know. It's pretty clear the purpose of this story is to beat Pritzker up for not paying enough for school and firefighters and police officers. Right.
I
get
think what you should do is have a conversation with Brenda, right? Yeah. You're moving back down here, right?
Yeah.
And obviously there's a whole culture shock between the cost of what it is to live in Minnesota versus Chicago. In your brand new place, you know, you're painting everything. Take the kitchens out. Brenda, wait, stay with me. We're going to save a ton of money. And then you lower your taxes and think of all the money you'll save. And what you can do is just use the bathroom at the station.
I could shower here. We have a little health facility downstairs.
Right. I think it makes perfect sense.
Okay, can I just read you one other sentence in this story?
Sure.
The Chicago Sun-Times over the weekend. The assessor, so this is interesting. It says separately, Barrio cut the assessment on the bigger mansion where the Pritzker family lives from $14 million to $12 million, resulting in a 16% property tax reduction. They went from $260,000 in their property taxes to $221,000. I don't know how people do this. Do you write a monthly check? Do you prorate it over the course of 12 months? But think about that. Your property taxes are $220,000. And that's after you got the appeal, a successful appeal. The assessor based his decision on an appraisal done by a company hired by the billionaire who refused to let the appraisers inside the home out of concerns for the security of his family. What? And Berrios,
wow.
Berrios agreed to keep the lowered assessments on both homes in place again this year. That's something I'm going to do. I'm going to tell the county, listen, Brenda and I and our dogs were so worried about assessors, because you always hear about assessors beating up dogs and wives and people. I mean, it's just terrible what those assessors do. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to go ahead and get my own guy. He's going to come in and tell you what it's worth, and then that's going to be the number you're going to do. Capiche? Is that how you use that word, capiche?
Right, capiche, yeah.
This is what happened here. And Berrios goes, okay, well, you better be pretty honest. I'd like to see some pictures, please. And so they sent pictures of some toilets lined up against the wall, maybe some water damage there. And they go, you can't inhabit this place. And they said, okay, if you have ever appealed a property tax reduction in the city or county, is that how it worked? Did that work for you? Because that's a new one on me. All right, that's my speech for today.
That's good.
Luke, it's nice to talk to you. We'll listen to you again on Saturday. I just wanted to sound you out on that, my friend.
Love you, Jenna.
That's the Lou Manfredini, our Mr. Fix-It. I got to take a break here in a few more minutes. Steve will do the news. Afterwards, an author's book is set in Chicago, so much so it's almost a character in the book. A little bit about that. And then a cybersecurity expert in the 2 o'clock hour talks about malware that is described as ransomware. It's fascinating. Would you pay the $300 if your computer went on the fritz and a message came up and said, get some Bitcoin, send $300 to this address, and we'll reactivate your computer and everything on it? Or not? They say they've made about $32,000 on this worldwide scam, which to me would be a fail. In general, Steve, do you agree with my notion that there should come a point after which your property taxes should not go up relative to the value of the property?
I mean, because you're paying so much?
Yeah. I mean, really, how many ambulances, firefighters, water, and schools can a guy use? If you have a $30 million house and it's 2%, then that's whatever that is.
I
don't think your taxes should be that high.
I haven't thought about that.
Oh, you got to start thinking about that.
There's not a ceiling for how much income tax you can pay, right?
No, there isn't. But, I mean, that's because you have money and we're going to take it.
Well, what's this?
Property taxes, I thought, were sort of based on the value of your house so that you could then fund the schools, pay for your fair share of the schools, pay for your fair share, you know, the fire department may have to come and put out your house. The cops may have to police your neighborhood. But you're not paying your fair share. You're paying everybody's fair share.
Fair share is a tricky thing to say.
I wish I hadn't used that phrase, to be honest.
Yeah, because someone
who's
paying, you know, hundreds of thousands in income tax would say that they're paying more than their fair share, too.
I guess
there's
no reason to stick up for billionaires. But in principle, it just seems to me like that's kind of ludicrous that your property tax should be $230,000.
Well, it must be a pretty dandy kitchen. Probably a walk-in closet.
So good. But here's the funny thing, though. Okay, so that's just my little aside. But back to the Sun-Times story on Sunday. In seeking the lower assessment for the vacant mansion that the Pritzkers bought, the company, they actually had a company that owned the home, but it's their house, the LLC, submitted the appraisal with photos of the disconnected toilets lined up along the wall, as well as an affidavit from Christine Lovely, an employee of Pritzker's wife, who asserted that the mansion was unfit for occupancy. The city, out of security concerns for the Pritzkers, agreed that they wouldn't go in and do a walkthrough, and that I don't even think the assessor they hired came into the house.
So you're saying that the house that they said was uninhabitable, they didn't send an assessor in for the safety of the Pritzker families who...
Correct.
Weren't inhabiting it in the first place.
Now that you mention it, good point. And for all of that hocus pocus, they go, wow, this is messed up. And then they drop their taxes dramatically. I just know too many people who've worked too hard to get their property taxes reduced. And the idea that you'd say, hey, listen, my wife's got a friend, and she says that place is not inhabitable.
I could not live there, honey.
We... And it's a Gold Coast mansion. And they go, you know, that really is kind of messed up. Okay, we'll take 83% off or 11% off. That's just, that's not how it works for the rest of us. I know the idea is to sometimes lower the taxes so that people invest in them. And that's how you sort of save neighborhoods or buildings. But this seems to be a little more than that. It's 140 on WGN. It's just lovely. We are sitting in the studio with Steve Hamilton. His latest book is Exit Strategy. It's a Nick Mason novel. It's set in Chicago so much you'd think Chicago was a character in the book. The Chicago Tribune said about his writing that it's amazing that somebody, now I'm not even going to quote him correctly here, but here's the essence of it, that it's hard for somebody who's not born and raised in Chicago to so get the city. And they said, you get the city. You understood Chicago as you wrote about this. That's high praise.
That felt really good. Yeah.
Welcome to the show. Welcome to the city.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
Again, you've been here before.
I've been here many times now, especially with the series set here. I've gotten to know this city so much better. And I've really fallen in love with it.
Who's Nick Mason?
Nick Mason is a career criminal that you meet in the first book, the Second Life of Nick Mason. Just in time to see him take a deal that will get him out of prison. He's doing 25 to life, hard time in a federal prison. And just imagine if you're in that position. And if you've ever been to a maximum security prison, I hope you haven't spent much time there.
I have been to a few.
It really is an amazing place, isn't it?
It's amazing anybody ever escapes, because it's hard to get in, let alone get out.
Just going to visit there, it's just, when that door closes behind you, even if you mentally know that you're getting out in an hour, there's something that it does to your body physically. It's just, you feel like a trapped animal. So just to be somebody who's sent to a place like that and know that you're never going to get out, I think you'd do anything to get out. And that's sort of what Nick, that's why Nick takes this deal, because he has to get out of that place and he has to come back to see his family again.
What did he do to get in?
He was part, you know, he was a criminal with these very strict rules for himself. He broke all of his rules for his friend, and they did a big takedown at the harbor, and he got caught. It was all set up. And so that's how he ends up in prison, and he takes the steal to get out. And he doesn't just get out. This is a Canaryville kid who gets out of prison and finds himself in Lincoln Park in a townhouse on the lake with a restored Mustang and a beautiful roommate and $10,000 cash at the beginning of every month. And the first book is really about how he discovers just what the price of that is, because he's got a cell phone, and whenever it rings, he has to answer it and go do whatever he's told to do, no matter what it is.
This deal wasn't made by the feds, wasn't made by the county, it was made by whom?
This is made by sort of a kingpin who's in prison,
yeah.
Named Madarius Cole.
And so they get him out, but now he's got to do their bidding
exactly,
on the outside.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you like this guy?
I like him a lot. It's sort of so, and everybody, that's one of the most amazing things about this experience. And as a writer, I've never written about a character like this before. Because when I was starting out, I would have been afraid to. Because this guy's a criminal. And I'd be afraid that nobody would want to root for him. You know, but as I, you know, this was like, I've done like 12 or 13 books up until this point, and I thought it was time to try it. And the response has just been amazing to it. And I think it's because they can relate to part of why he's doing this. I mean, some of the scenes with his daughter, those are the scenes that people talk about the most. That's the one thing that you can really relate to him on.
Tell me about one of those scenes.
Well, there's a scene late in the first book where he finally sees his daughter in the flesh again for the first time in 5 years. You know, she's 9 years old now. He hasn't seen her since he was four. And he tells her that he made a big mistake and that all he ever wanted to do was be her daddy. And it's just people really talk about that scene a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like it doesn't quite redeem him as a character, but you can sort of, it just makes you feel differently about
it. See the humanity in him anyway. But then why doesn't he just, well, I guess in where the story is now, he doesn't have any choice.
He doesn't have any choice.
He can't give up his occupation.
Well, that's really the point of the second book, which is called Exit Strategy. And it's really about his exit strategy, because these missions that he's being sent on, they're getting more and more dangerous, for one thing. But also just inside him, he's starting to feel like he's turning into this machine that Darius Cole sort of is creating in him. And he's sort of just losing himself. He's losing his humanity.
How many kills does he have to go on for this guy?
Well, in this book, I think it's really three in this book.
Is that fun to imagine? Okay, he's going to have to go kill somebody. He could push him off of the Sears Tower. Or he could drown him in the lake, or he could push him in front of the L. Listen to me now. I'm revealing my own complicated psyche. But I mean, is that what somebody like you goes through?
That's part of the fun part of being a crime writer.
I did say fun, didn't I?
It is. It is. That's it's funny how you. I don't know if you've had other crime writers on the show. They're usually the most laid-back, coolest people. All these guys, Jack Reacher, the Lee Child and Michael Conley. And I think it's because we get to kill people. I think it is.
Yeah. And are you careful to, in order to generate sympathy for your character, make sure that the people that he has to go on assignment for deserve it, that there's no sympathy for them?
You're conscious of that, but I try not to cheat too much, because that would be too easy, just to make everybody that he has to go after just a total bastard who had it coming.
In real life, Chicago can't seem to break its crime grip. Did that inform you? Did you worry that might discount the desire to read a book like yours?
Well, it did creep into this book a little bit. One of the characters, Frank Sandoval, he is a homicide detective, which is a pretty tough job in this city right now. And I've gotten to know a lot of police in this city. And I have a friend, John, who is a homicide detective. And he gets up every day just to do this job that I can't even imagine. And so for Frank Sandoval, I was aware that a lot of these guys feel like they're the enemy now, that the job wasn't already hard enough when they...
That the detectives feel like they're the enemy?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, just the police in general. After all the things that have happened, and we know all the things that have happened. And somebody like John is just as upset about those things as anybody else, because he knows that that's just bad policing when things like that happen. But it makes his job harder, a lot harder.
You say it's bad policing. You know what I was thinking in my head was that it's the policing can't fix it. That if we talk about this, I think the problem with crime in this city is not bad policing. I think it's bad neighborhoods. It's people. I mean, the cops can't fix the problem. Is my
point?
Well, of course.
But I mean, when you have a bad cop, when you have one bad cop, that's what I meant about bad policing. Not that the whole system is bad,
right?
But that you have one bad cop out of 12,000. Or you have just a handful of bad cops out of 12,000 great cops who are doing their job. It doesn't take much. It takes one incident caught on film, as we all know all too well, and it reflects on everybody. And John, somebody like John is just as frustrated by that as anybody else.
A Nick Mason novel, Exit Strategy, by Steve Hamilton. Steve's in our studio. It's set in Chicago. What do you love about Chicago when you're writing about the city?
I love the fact, I always knew that there were neighborhoods in Chicago, but every city has neighborhoods. But Chicago, every one of these neighborhoods seems to just to be distinct in a way that I haven't seen in any other city.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is a beautiful place too. It's a beautiful city. It is the Paris of America.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I mean, where we are sitting right now would be the Eiffel Tower. I'm not kidding. I mean, some of the particular buildings right where we are, including the one that we are in, are some of the prettiest buildings with the prettiest views in the country.
Yeah, and you walk down by the river. It's just it's a gorgeous city. It's a great American city.
Yeah. Really, a little bit more about your book and about what's happening with it in a minute. It's 149 on WGN. Steve Hamilton's in our studio. It says here on the cover, New York Times bestselling author, a Nick Mason novel, Exit Strategy, Uncorrected Proof for Limited Distribution. Not everybody will be getting that one.
No, but I brought you the real one here. So
yeah, because it drops tomorrow. It's in bookstores tomorrow.
It is tomorrow, yeah.
And then you'll be doing the signings and the speakings and the stuff like that.
Yep.
What's a passage that you read from this book? Is there an anecdote in here that you are especially proud of?
I actually don't read out loud that much. I'm just not that good at it. And I like just going to these bookstores. And it's really, writing is a pretty lonely job. And you're up in your room late at night just telling these stories to yourself, it feels like sometimes. And you can almost forget that there are people out there who are going to read this stuff. So when you go to a bookstore and you see people there who actually like came out to meet you and talk to you, and just to, and they've spent all this time with this character, just like it feels like they know this character as well as you do. That's really an amazing feeling, especially these days where everything has to happen in a minute, for somebody to spend hours reading a hardcover novel.
Yeah.
And then to come talk to you about it. It's the best feeling in the world.
Does that motivate you?
It does. It keeps me going. It's really the thing that keeps me, that makes me realize just how lucky I am to be able to do this.
The first in the series was optioned, but that didn't get made into a movie, did it? Or a TV show?
It's going to be.
It
takes a while. Yeah. Lionsgate is working on it right now.
So it'll be the motion picture version of the book.
Right.
Who's going to star?
Well, if we have a time machine, we'll go back in time and get a young Steve McQueen. So obviously,
and we don't.
So it's got to be just somebody good, somebody who can play him and maybe play him again in another one. We hope.
Have any of your books previously been made into movies or TV shows?
No.
I've heard from authors who have. They say when you agree, you have to let it go.
You do.
And that's the hardest thing to do because that's your Steve McQueen. That's your Nick Mason. Right. And doggone it, now they're getting somebody to play him that doesn't look like you had in mind that you wrote. Or maybe they just don't capture it. They're not directing it the way you wrote it.
That happens a lot. And, you know, we know a lot of movies that get made from books that just don't work. But the people doing this, it's Nina Jacobson, who did The Hunger Games. It's Shane Salerno, who's working on the Avatar sequels, and he's adapting the one of Don Winslow's books right now for Ridley Scott. These guys really get it. They really love this book, and they know what's special about it, I think.
So they're going to shoot it in Chicago, then?
They're going to film it right here in Chicago.
Promise me they're not using Toronto or some fake Chicago.
Right here in Chicago, which will be really fun to come back and watch that happen.
So will you be here? Are you going to consult on the script?
Of course I am.
Yeah. And are they going to be racing up and down Michigan Avenue right here?
Right outside this window. That would
Here's
be cool.
what you should have. Have them drive the car out the corncob tower and into the river. That's been done before, but I love that scene. That's a great Chicago movie scene.
That's right.
In fact, I guess that's what you kind of want to do. When you're writing, do you think this will be good in the movie someday?
You don't really think of that when you're writing a novel that much. I mean, I think that would be distracting. If you were too hung up on that,
I would get completely hung up on that.
Yeah, you just want it to work. You want the character, mostly on a character level, you want it to work first.
Well, do you go to a restaurant or will you see somebody on the street in Chicago and go, oh, that was such a Chicago moment? I'm going to make a mental note and somehow integrate that.
That's what a writer does all the time with everything in your life, yeah.
So then you scribble that down or do you make a mental note?
One or the other. If I have paper, I do like always have something. I'm always writing stuff down.
Do people then, would they recognize themselves, anecdotes, scenes, friends, family members, people that you met?
No, it goes into the swamp. That's what Stephen King calls it. Everything that goes into his head goes into a swamp. And it comes out later, all sort of turned into something else.
So if you sort of amalgamated then these Chicagoans and these experiences, last question, if you will.
Okay.
What's Chicago like and what's a Chicagoan like?
Wow.
You better get this right.
Wow, that's a tough one. Chicagoan is a tough, hardworking person, first of all. There's a saying about Detroit that it's a city that can't get by on its good looks. I think Chicago is the one city that could but doesn't, because Chicago does look good, but they still act like they don't.
Well, that's a good answer. Mm. That's a good answer.
You go.
Have you been asked that? Have you answered it that way before?
I just came up with that. I swear to God.
You should be a writer. That just happened. It's nice to meet you. Well, good luck. So you'll be able to buy the book on bookshelves tomorrow. You'll be able to get it online too. Steve Hamilton's Exit Strategy is the second Nick Mason novel, and I'm anxious to see him make the movie when it comes to town. It's nice to meet you, Steve. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you very much.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
All right, I got one. It goes like this. Mm-hmm. Steve, you asked in your news, are you worried about the Chicago Cubs? Here's my response. I am not worried about the Chicago Cubs, but I've also resigned myself that this year isn't going to be as much fun as last year. Last year was just all Rizzo catches and home runs and one-hitters and sunshine and lollipops. And I think it's going to be a slog this year. and we'll crawl into the playoffs. This is my current thinking. It could change by next weekend. And then we'll be fine, and we'll be in the World Series.
Right. Well, you know, they are the best team in baseball.
But I wanted to enjoy it. What's the point of winning the World Series and being this, you know, sort of wonder team if you can't win in April and May? Come on.
What's your point? You mean they should be winning now? You're not enjoying it?
Ask the question you asked again.
What's your point?
No, the one about are you worried?
Are you worried?
Yeah, I'm worried.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Ask it again.
Are you still worried?
No, I'm not worried. We'll be fine.
everything's going to be okay.
We'll be fine, but it would be a lot more fun if we were like 9 games over .500. If we had the Yankees record, why can't we have the Yankees record?
You know, that was last year's win, and then this year I think it's got to be a little harder to appreciate it as much.
Well, they say that it's just so difficult in any sport, and baseball's included, to repeat. It just does not happen. And here's why. Look at us.
It's only May 15th.
I know, but I'm already mad at Schwarber, and I shouldn't be.
You're mad at Schwarber?
Sure I am.
Really?
Because he only hits to the right side. They have 17 people standing between first base and second base.
Wait, so the guy who
picnic tables in right field.
The guy who only had one at-bat in the regular season and then came back for the World Series to help propel them to the World Series. That's the guy you're mad at?
Thank you for that, but now I need you to get some hits, and I would... If I were him, I would try and hit it to the left side. And if you say, well, he can't, he's a pull hitter, then I'm thinking, oh, well, then we have a problem here, don't we? These shifts are killing me. They're killing me.
I lost my Little League coach, Kenny Smith, this year, unfortunately. But if he were around, he would tell Kyle to go with the pitch.
I know, outside pitches.
Go with the pitch.
Punch those. When's the last time he had a line drive to left center? It can be done. It can be done. That's a hit.
There are people laughing at you in here.
Chris Bryant does it. I know you're not Chris Bryant. I like what you are, but doggone it, you're leaving a lot of hits on the table there.
And the pitching's just terrible, John.
It has not been so good. So it's not going to be as much fun as it was last year. It's 2:10. This is WGN Radio. I'm John Williams. On a phone line is, where's his name? Kevin Epstein. He is the head of threat operations at Proofpoint. I want to talk a little bit about what happened with this malware, which, did you see it? It's described as ransomware. Kevin, you're on WGN Radio in Chicago. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
Pleasure. I'm well, thanks. But it's been a busy few days.
I guess you didn't see this one coming either. I mean, these things, or are there threats in advance for something like this?
The criminals don't tend to warn you too much in advance, a few exceptions to that, but we've seen new variants of ransomware every 2 to 3 days. That said, this one was significantly more proliferating than most of them.
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, I get it. But I mean, really, so ransomware goes out all of the time. People are doing this all the time, huh?
Your computers get kidnapped. Well, someone's computer gets kidnapped every day.
Huh. And describe ransomware. How does that work?
So when an attacker gets the ransomware onto your system, the first time you'll know it is when, instead of seeing your normal desktop, you'll just see a large screen saying, your computer's been locked, and providing instructions on how to pay the ransom. Effectively, what they've done is kidnap your files by encrypting every file on your computer. So your computer still functions. It's just everything you had is locked up in a way that you won't ever get back unless you pay this ransom.
So I could still open up my browser and surf the internet?
Depending upon how thoroughly they've locked your computer, most of them do leave the browser open because that's one of the ways they encourage you to pay the ransoms, by sending them Bitcoin to certain web addresses.
But all your files, all your photos, all your everything that's stored on that computer is now hijacked. If it's been saved to another source, the cloud or another hard drive, if it's been backed up some way, then can you just throw the computer away and at least have everything back?
If you backed it up and then that backup was not attached to your laptop at the time that you were infected with ransomware, then absolutely. That the frequent offline backups are one of the best sources of protection. Unfortunately, many people leave their backup drive connected, at which point the ransomware may encrypt not only your physical local hard drive, but also any connected drives.
I have a Mac, and everything is automatically saved to the cloud. I wonder if I'm safe or vulnerable.
Cross your fingers, assuming the backup works in the standard Mac cloud backup way, you should be in very good shape. That said, if I were you, I might perform a restore and check that.
Yeah, like I know how to do that. So then somebody gets this message on the screen, and it says, okay, if you want it back, you have to pay. I read $200-$300 for individuals, thousands and thousands for hospitals. Does that sound about right?
It sounds about right. It typically runs a couple hundred dollars per laptop, which if you own a lot of laptops, ends up being quite a few thousand dollars.
And then you pay in Bitcoin? Is that the idea?
Absolutely. And for those of folks not familiar with Bitcoin, it's a so-called cyber currency. Standard currencies like U.S. dollars can be entered into payment sites, converted to this cyber currency, which is then deliverable anywhere in the world and far less traceable or restricted.
So I would have to get a Bitcoin account, transfer money. I don't know exactly what I'm saying here, but I'd find some way to monetize these Bitcoin, and then I would send those Bitcoin to some person out there, huh?
Exactly. And the good news or bad news is that the ransomware providers usually provide very detailed, fairly straightforward to follow instructions in the ransomware.
And then
they have a very good customer service model.
And do they then unencrypt? Does your computer work afterwards?
So traditionally, with low amounts of ransomware, the kidnappers, if you will, are actually fairly reasonable about restoring your computer because they wanted an ongoing business model. If people
right.
learned that you paid the ransom and they didn't give you the key, well, that wouldn't last long. Unfortunately, this latest outbreak appears to have taken the attackers by surprise in terms of the number of infected computers. And so they appear to be unable to keep up with the demand for decryption keys. The rumors we're hearing are that folks are paying and they receive a message that says something about, you know, please wait a week or two.
All of our operators are standing by. Well, so people pay. They actually do then. They go through this rigmarole and send a few hundred bucks off. God, that's got to hurt.
It depends what your photos and lifetime memories are worth. It's not encouraged to pay the attackers. Clearly, it incensed the wrong behavior. But again, it's a personal choice. And if your system's not backed up and you have your, you know, wedding photos or child's photos or personal important records you couldn't replicate, it may not be too high a price.
I read that this operation may not have been so sophisticated since, or at least the person that did it, since it was accidentally stopped. It was just somebody registering a domain name that was in part of the encryption. So maybe these guys aren't so good at it, but I'm pretty impressed. Just talk to me about who this person might have been.
So there is rampant speculation that this ransomware was accidentally released early, if you will. There were a number of aspects to it, aspects of the code, the speed with which it spread, the obvious lack of preparation of the attackers for the volume of decryption requests they had. But the code itself was very sophisticated in other ways. They were using a leaked National Security Agency exploit, and it was very fortunate that our researchers here at Proofpoint found early samples and collaborated with another researcher to find that kill switch. Without that, we would still all be dealing with this at very high volume, likely today.
And the kill switch was, in fact, registering the domain name, right?
Yeah, there was a piece of the code that when the malware infected a computer, before proceeding to trigger the ransomware and spread itself everywhere else, it reached out and said, can I see this website? And if the answer was no, it proceeded with its attack. Simply registering that website and making that website present so that the malware saw it effectively killed the malware, stopped it.
But how did you know which domain name to register?
Our researchers got a sample of early malware and reverse engineered it, decompiled it, and found this call out to the non-existent domain, and speculated. Again, when one is taking apart code, it's not always clear what it's trying to do. So they looked at it carefully and said, "Gosh, this looks like it doesn't do anything if it breaches that domain, and the domain is not there. Well, let's put it up and see what happens."
And that stopped. And that stopped the virus in its tracks, huh?
And that stopped the spread for now. The challenge being, you know, just like the flu getting out there. Once the flu is out there, there are all kinds of versions of the flu, if you will. And this, unfortunately, is something that now that it's out there, we've already seen evidence of people tinkering with it to eliminate the kill switch, make it more effective, conceal it better, et cetera.
But everybody who gets this virus, your computer is then going to go say, "Hey, is this domain name registered?" And the answer was, no, it's not registered, and therefore it steals all your stuff or locks it up. But now that the domain name has been registered, then it doesn't harm you, as I understand it. What was the domain name then? What was the word that they had to register?
I can't possibly pronounce this. It's a 26-character random... it's almost like Sesame Street, where you try and pronounce the alphabet.
26 letters,
A very long, maybe more than that. It's a very random alphanumeric string.
Really, just a bunch of random stuff. So it wasn't like something clever, like wannacryevenmore.com or something, huh?
Yeah, apparently our attackers had no sense of humor.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, or desire for fame, because then that would have been maybe... the thing that they would best be known for. Well, actually, we know it is WannaCry. Why was this called WannaCry?
One can only speculate. CRY in the security world is often short for crypt or encryption, and often you see things like crypto locker, crypto wall. So this may have been intended to be WannaCrypt, wanna encrypt. That said, speaking for security defenders and researchers everywhere, by the end of Friday, until we'd found that kill switch, I would certainly empathize with the name WannaCry.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense, too. I mean, you want to cry? You're going to be crying if you don't pay the ransom. And so while this one has it shut down or affected 1 in 5 hospitals in Great Britain, 70, 80, 90 countries, depending on what you read, millions of people across the world, but it didn't seem to hit the United States so much as it did Europe, right?
It definitely seemed to be spreading sort of across the globe, literally based on the speed of the speed of the internet,
yeah.
The speed with which computers were turned on and
right.
came online. And since it started sort of late night, early morning Friday for the U.S., the U.S. was fortunate in that it was later in the infection stage, but very, very, very rapid spread through Friday until that kill switch was found.
One last thing, Kevin Epstein, he's the head of threat operations at Proofpoint. Were people just by having their computers on getting infected, or did you have to click on an attachment?
One of the nastier pieces of this piece of ransomware was that it self-proliferated. It's what's called a network worm, mainly meaning that if your laptop was on and running an unpatched version of a Microsoft operating system, the ransomware could insert itself onto your system, send itself to other systems your system could see, and then trigger the ransomware, locking you up and asking for money.
Okay, but a lot of times, you know, people, they say, well, why did you click on that thing? You don't know that email, and that's an odd-looking attachment, so don't do that. And, you know, sometimes you go, that was pretty stupid for you to do, but that's not the scenario here, correct?
My favorite advice to tell people is don't click, and in this case, it didn't matter. All you had to be was online and unpatched, which is my second favorite piece of advice is please always make sure that your systems are up to date. When the little update window pops up on your laptop, I don't care if it's Apple or PC or what have you, say yes. After being sure that it's a real pop-up window, not something
spawned
by an attacker.
Yeah, really. But unpatched. So you're saying just keep your system, your operating system updated?
It was, in this case, it was that simple. So computers that had been updated with the appropriate patches were completely immune to this. Computers that were not updated were wide open, effectively.
Okay. Nice to talk to you, Kevin. Anything we can do for you? I guess you're in the business. If folks want to know more about how to protect themselves, they should reach out to Proofpoint.
Absolutely. Take a look at proofpoint.com. If you're an individual user, we just have a section marked Threat Insight, which hopefully provides some useful information. And if you're a corporation, of course, we're in the business and would be happy to hopefully assist or refer you to others.
Kevin Epstein, head of threat operations. It sounds positively military at proofpoint.com. Nice to talk to you, Kevin. I sure appreciate your help today.
A pleasure as well. And again, best with the Cubs.
Oh, yeah. You want to get on that conversation? Are you worried about the Cubs, Kevin?
You know, I never worry about the Cubs.
well, yeah.
I don't know, but the Sox, you know, who can pull defeat from the jaws of victory. It's nice to see a team that works the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so you're in California, right?
And so now I'm with the Giants, but I have to say it's not the same spirit. Back East has a different spirit to it.
Back East meaning here in Illinois, yeah. Okay. Nice to talk to you, Kevin. We will absolutely reach out to you again. Thanks for helping us out.
My pleasure.
You know, a little while ago we visited with the author of the Chicago-based book Exit Strategy. Steve Hamilton was in our studio. It's his latest Nick Mason novel. He's all about Chicago. I asked him to autograph the book afterwards, and he did. I've got it for my collection. But I posted the picture of his autograph. It's really something. If you follow me on Twitter, I'm WGN King John on Twitter. You'll see what I mean when you see his autograph. And about our guest that was just on with us now, Kevin Epstein, the head of threat operations at Proofpoint. You remember the world when there wasn't even such a thing as the head of threat operations at Proofpoint? But now that's a thing, and now you need to know and care. Here's his resume. Kevin Epstein is a Silicon Valley marketing executive with a Stanford MBA and a degree in high-energy nuclear physics. Do you think he's just making that up? Do you really think he has an MBA from Stanford and a degree in high-energy nuclear physics? I'm not even sure that is a thing. I was in a client meeting recently where a salesperson from our radio station and a prospective business who will advertise on our radio station were all getting together. And the salesperson introduced me. She goes, "This is John Williams. He's one of our hosts. He is a nuclear physicist." And I said, "I'm not a nuclear physicist." She says, "It says that on your bio." And I said, "That was a funny thing I put in the bio." And she goes, "Oh, I thought it was true."
And she said, "Nuclear physicists aren't funny. This is proof."
Yeah, really. In fact, I would have thought you were a nuclear physicist. You're so unfunny. I said, "Oh, no, it's not working. I thought that when I put that in there, everybody would go, ha, 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 ha." But now I'm being introduced as a nuclear physicist. So then we had that awkward moment where the client's face kind of fell, and they went, "Oh, well, we thought we were getting a nuclear physicist to sell our thing. It's this? It's just this guy?" It was this guy. Anyway, he's got a Stanford MBA and a degree in high-energy nuclear physics, right? And then he's got experience in retail. He's worked for 15 years in guerrilla marketing and has worked for Netscape, Real Networks, VMware, and Scalent Systems. Again, things that didn't even used to exist. Bernie Madoff, how many years ago was it that he stole from millions of people? Well, maybe not millions of people, maybe millions of people. But when the Bernie Madoff thing went down, we were all aghast that a pyramid scheme like that could be so vast and it would work. And now HBO's made a movie about it, starring Robert De Niro, and Michelle Pfeiffer is his wife. And it looks really good. It's based on Diana Enriquez's book, Wizard of Lies. She's going to say hi to us after the news. HBO has the new Bernie Madoff movie. The trailer in part sounds like this.
"For 16 years, I kept this secret from my wife, my brother, my sons. I was able to do that and maintain any degree of sanity. That worries me when I think about it.
Mom, do you understand what he's done?
I just want to know what's going on.
There's a 17th floor?
You're asking me how I didn't know.
What's going on?
How did you not know?
What'd you do with the money? Money.
We're here to find out if there's an innocent explanation.
There is no innocent explanation."
He looks like Bernie Madoff. The thing just looks gripping. It'll turn your stomach if you pause and think, oh, it's true. And lives were ruined by Bernie Madoff. And if you read Diana Henriquez's book, Wizard of Lies, you know that it's just a a fantastic story, which begins with her being the first person outside of his attorneys to meet him in jail and talk to him about why he did what he did. The book is worth the read without the movie, but now you got them both. And Diana joins us again on WGN Radio. Diana, it's John Williams. Welcome back. How have you been?
I've been well, John, and thank you so much. Those were riveting segments that you aired there.
Have you seen the movie?
I have. I was at the premiere in New York on Thursday night. It's amazing. It really is just amazing how De Niro so completely transforms himself into Bernie Madoff in a way, John, that really helps you understand how people fell under the spell of this dangerous sociopath.
7 o'clock HBO Saturday night. 7 o'clock on HBO Saturday night. Is it true to the book?
Yes, it is amazingly faithful. I was a consultant to HBO as part of the arrangement, legal arrangements for adapting the book. And frankly, John, I thought it was going to be kind of a pro forma, you know, arrangement where HBO kind of, you know, gives me a consulting contract and pats me on the head and says, "Nice little author, go away and be quiet." But in fact, I was deeply involved and consulted through the script construction process, even in some of the set design questions. And my feedback was always respected and taken seriously. I am very, very pleased with how the story has been adapted.
Okay, I'm interested. I only know it by the book, and I think that's fantastic. Give us start with the, what year did Bernie Madoff go down?
He was arrested on December 11th, 2008.
So let's just sort of back up, Diana. What happened? What did Bernie Madoff do?
Well, he had begun his career, John, as a up-and-coming young one-man show trading over-the-counter stocks back in 1960 when, you know, anybody with a pulse could make money on OTC stocks, but he had more than a pulse. He had a real brain and a real talent for it. On the side, he started managing money for friends and family. That side business slowly grew, and then at some point, and we're not really sure, I think it was certainly by the mid-80s, Bernie denies that and says it wasn't until 1993, that private side of his business became a Ponzi scheme, and it grew into the largest Ponzi scheme in history. It stretched around the world from Palm Beach to the Persian Gulf. People from, you know, glittery Hollywood celebrities down to carpenter union pensioners lost money in this massive fraud when it collapsed. And the paradox is that all through that time, the Bernie Madoff I knew on Wall Street was running one of the most respected wholesale trading firms on the street, had a squeaky clean regulatory record, admired, respected by everybody. It was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
In other words, that legitimate business existed at the same time that the illegitimate one did.
It did. It ran in like a parallel universe, really.
Was he using the one to fund the other or cover the other?
Well, not initially. I mean, his wholesale trading business was really very successful until the advent of decimalization, when changes in stock prices began to be calculated in smaller and smaller fractions. And at that point, the legitimate firm came under some profit pressure. And in the very final years of the fraud, he began to channel money from his Ponzi slush fund into the legitimate business, masquerading it, masking it as profits from his investment management side.
Wow.
So as the money came in, he funneled it. His henchman, Frankie DiPasquale, channeled it through their London office, so it would come in to the legitimate firm looking like profits from that private side of the business into the legitimate trading firm. But that was a development fairly late in the fraud, John.
Was it his idea all along to operate a Ponzi scheme and not operate it legitimately, or was he simply making bad trades and now he needed to cover for them?
I don't think we'll ever know the honest answer to that. There was an incident I describe in my book that occurred in 1962. John, you'll recall, there was that May 1962, what they call the air pocket drop in the market. It was the worst week in the market since 1929. And Bernie had only maybe a couple of dozen private investors at that point, but they were wiped out in the first hours of that crash. He'd put them, you know, these small-time savers, he'd put them in these wildly speculative stocks, and he lost all their money for them. Well, what did he do? He could have admitted what had happened and admitted the losses and admitted he had failed, or he could have covered all their losses secretly out of his own pocket and lied about it, and that's what he did. So clearly there is a facet of Bernie Madoff's personality that cannot admit failure. So I think as long as he could make money honestly, as long as he could be a hero money manager, a genius on Wall Street, honestly, he'd do that. But if he had to choose between cheating and failing, he'd cheat.
And if somebody thought, well, at least that's admirable, but it's not admirable if he's doing it with the next investor's money, making it sound like I've got a profitable concern here. You put money in, but now the money coming in is funding the losses or the exits for other people. And now you've got a Ponzi scheme on your hands. Yes. Did he think, though, okay, but someday I'm going to get upright on this thing and then I won't have to do that anymore?
I think he did. He says he did. And, of course, you know, when you think about it, a Ponzi scheme is the opposite of a perfect crime. I mean, there are a few ways out of a Ponzi scheme besides, you know, suicide in prison. I mean, it's just really hard to get out of them. So if you know, he must rationally have thought that he would be able to make enough money at some point to pay back the money he'd stolen to cover other withdrawals, so that he could make people whole. But it became impossible as more and more billions of dollars poured into this fund.
Did his wife or sons know?
My conviction is that they did not. That is the conclusion I reached in my book after almost 2 years of research. It is a conclusion that has held up in the test of time. Not one Post-it note has surfaced in all of the investigations, all of the bankruptcy trustees' investigations. Nothing has surfaced that implicates Ruth or either of the two Madoff sons. And certainly that is the story that is portrayed in the HBO drama.
She didn't go to jail. She was not pressed. There were no charges against her, right?
Never. Never. She was almost immediately given innocent spouse status by the IRS. As their investigation into Madoff's tax liabilities expanded, neither of the sons were ever the target or the subject of a criminal investigation.
Yeah.
We confirmed that fairly early in the drama.
How was Ruth living then? It's tragic what's happened to this family, because one of their sons committed suicide, right?
On the second anniversary of his father's arrest, he committed suicide.
And the other son?
The other son died of cancer in September 2014.
Can you imagine?
It was a form of cancer he had beaten a decade earlier. He had fought it off as a younger man, and he told me soon after his diagnosis in early 2013. That he felt that the stress of his father's scandal had left him vulnerable to a recurrence of the disease and an opportunistic infection.
How is Ruth living then? Does she live comfortably or is she a pauper now?
Well, not a pauper. She is essentially on an allowance from the trustee as they work towards a final settlement in the litigation he has filed against her. She was left a portion of her assets, about $2.5 million, by the bank, by the U.S. Attorney's Office, by the Justice Department. The trustee has sued her for $44 million, which she transparently doesn't have. So she has a potential liability that leaves her far, far in debt. But she is working. Her attorneys are working towards eventually a settlement of that case.
Mm-hmm.
She's living quietly in a private community in Greenwich in a house that she rents. She doesn't own the home, and it's not clear once litigation is cleared up, what she will do. So she's, but you know, she's sustained by loving grandchildren who take beautiful care of her, and she obviously isn't happy with all of this new publicity.
Yeah, I'll bet. Let me ask you one last question, Diane. I've got like 45 seconds. How many people and how many dollars were affected by the Bernie Madoff scheme?
Well, the cash losses are relatively easy to estimate, John. They were about $17 to $20 billion in cash was lost.
Any idea how many people that touched?
You know, I have seen an estimate that ran as high as 3 million people worldwide. Now, that includes the grant recipients from charities that had to close their doors, the pensioners of union pension funds. So it could be that. We have documented at, almost 10,000 people. So at least thousands, possibly millions.
On HBO, Saturday night at 7 o'clock, Wizard of Lies, the title of your book, Diana Enriquez's book, is worth a read. I presume I can still get this at bookstores everywhere, Diana?
You can get it with Robert De Niro and Michelle Pfeiffer's photos on the front.
That's a good day for
it's
you.
A beautiful new cover.
Nice to talk to you. Congratulations once again.
Thank you. Thanks again.
It's a 252. Rokan and the gang are ready to come bustling in here in a minute on WGN. I think Nina Metz got it right in the Tribune today when she wrote about Saturday Night Live, and she was a little underwhelmed about Melissa McCarthy as Sean Spicer. She said about this pre-taped segment, it was all kinds of unrealized potential.
All right, let me just put this whole Russian thing to bed once and for all. Trump is innocent. How do we know? Because he told us so. Period. Okay, then he hired lawyers to agree with him. And they're going to prove it with a certified letter, which you know is the truth because it costs an extra $2 to have it certified.
Pretty funny, right? I mean, it was at times, but it was kind of all over the place. And I wanted to see her driving that podium in and out of traffic more. I thought that was going to be really hilarious. And for some reason, it just didn't connect with me. And then at the end, Donald Trump finally summons her. They have this awkward exchange, and then they end up mouth-kissing. And it was a bizarre end about which Metz said the kiss made no sense. And you have to wonder why sexual conduct between two men is still a punchline in 2017. There's not much comedic precision when the show takes on politics or its players, but you knew that. Yeah, I guess so. But I think she's right. That just disappointed. You know what I thought was better was, and it wasn't perfect either, it just seemed to me like they were missing a lot of lines Saturday night, was Michael Shea and Alec Baldwin recreating that interview.
I fired him because of Russia. I thought, he's investigating Russia. I don't like that. I should fire him.
And you're just admitting that?
Uh-huh.
But that's obstruction of justice.
Sure, okay.
Wait, so did I get him? Is this all over? Oh, no, I didn't. Nothing matters. Absolutely nothing matters anymore.
And that was the point. So Shea's Lester Holt really nails it, doesn't he? It's like, no, nothing matters. Because you think, oh, wow, that's it. You're done. You're toast. You just admitted to corruption or obstruction of justice. And then, nah, it doesn't matter. And when he said that, I think a lot of people went, that's it. They got it there. More props to them for the second one than the first.